2L2K E keep the M U to keep the music on in that in there H A
hands
mm-hmm. Yes, to keep the music in their hands.
Right. Do I have to speak up, or is this like?
Can you hear Peter when he talks? Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, can the mic hear me?
The mic picks it up. Yeah. They C H A charge even though we don't make any money,
right?
They still charge. They have like a thing that you plug in the numbers, and we're like so minuscule in their thing that we don't even register on their chart. So in that case, you have to pay this like amount that they came up with.
They have a basic flat fee.
Yes, that's and we're shame. So way below anything mm-hmm. that would come into
you
that.
You should get it prorated down to where you are.
Yes,
and that would be reasonable.
Yes. Mm. I would not am I mind if they C H charged by how much you make. They charge by how much
exactly.
you make, yes.
That would be right.
Yeah.
Give them a share of your profits.
Right. But that is N E never
going to happen.
Never going to happen. Never how
they do it.
They do it. That is never how they do it, yes. What is D E E
D politics.
Yes.
D politics. Well, I wrote a book about Vietnam, and I was trying to look at the source, the real reasons why we went to war. I mean, it was not because we wanted to defend freedom. There were a lot of reasons that weren't being spoken, and some of them were bureaucratic reasons. Some of them were oil interests and other economic interests. And in that book, The War Conspiracy, I came up with a word, parapolitics, which is all the kind of covert things that are going on. And that word parapolitics has caught on because if you go and just search for it on the web, you get like 400 or 500 entries now. But I realized there were two different kinds of things. There were things which somebody in the CIA cooked up intentionally, and that's classic parapolitics. And there are some things which happen just really because they're out of anyone's control, but they're a very important feature of our society. And here, the best example I give is the mafia. The government didn't invent the mafia. The mafia is just there. But the government has had to work with the mafia in various ways, and anything in that area which they don't generally admit to but is going on would be deep politics. And a big example is the easiest example is Italy after World War II. The America and the CIA actually imported American mafia figures to help fight the communists and essentially kill communists. They murdered them. That was parapolitical because the government didn't admit its role. But ever since then, Italy has been, has had a huge mafia problem where the mafia is killing attorney generals and chiefs of police. This is not anybody's, the way anybody wants it now. It's just a state of affairs. That's a classic deep political situation.
And, you know, I always have wondered how P.O.R. organized
crime,
organized and C. crime, how organized and crime, no, how organized and C.
R.
E. N. T.
R.
E. Oh. Center.
Central.
Centralized.
Maybe Central Intelligence.
The D. E. E. Deep politics are. How you've often wondered how organized and centralized deep politics are.
And I don't really have an easy answer to that because at the heart of this country are things which are still a mystery to me. Like take the drug traffic. I think that this war on drugs we're fighting now is a favor to the drug cartels. It keeps the price up. It keeps the little dealers out, makes it impossible for people to grow their own dope, puts them in the hands of the big cartels. But how centralized is that? I really don't know. I think that, I think we'd have to do it case by case. I think that there was a decision of the U.S. government to work with drug lords in Asia, which was a very centralized decision because they saw these Kuomintang drug lords as a chief asset in stopping the spread of communism from China. But I'm not so sure how centralized it is with the cocaine coming from Latin America. We've had cartels fighting each other. I think it's probably less centralized there. But the more research I do, the more I see the hands of governments in what the cartels are doing.
And, no, I, H, A, had to B, L, Black Panthers, who said, who S, A, I, who said, D, drugs, R, was, B,
being,
O,
no,
you,
bought,
no, brought into the black neighborhoods to D, I, S, T,
destroy the black leadership.
Yes, to destroy the black leadership.
Well, I saw with my own eyes. You know, a lot of the methamphetamine in Oakland used to be distributed by the Hells Angels. And this is going way back now, but when we had the Vietnam War and the first great big anti-war march going into Oakland, it wasn't stopped by the Oakland police. It was stopped by the Hells Angels. And the Oakland police were watching while the Hells Angels beat up on the people in the crowd. They went so crazy that they even broke the leg of a Berkeley policeman. It was all on the border between Berkeley and Oakland. And visibly you could see the Hells Angels were working with the Oakland police to stop our march, even though everyone knew that they were distributors of methamphetamines in Oakland. Again, I don't know how centralized this is. I think that a lot of the mood of this country in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, was that the local police and the FBI would rather deal with criminals, who after all were capitalists of a sort, than deal with radicals. And I think that it did happen. How intentional this was, I don't know, but you had a period where there was a lot of black organizing by the Panthers, and then the FBI pretty well, you know, they killed Panthers, they jailed Panthers, but there was still organizing. And then the drugs came in, and it was the drugs that stopped the organizing, because so many of the young organizers became dealers.
And C H E A, cheap
drugs.
G, guns.
Guns, yes. Right.
The B L Black Panthers. A L also T O told about when the C O the cops J U just L let A B O box a boxcar full of what was it full of guns they let a boxcar full of guns in to a poor black neighborhood.
Yeah. There's this interesting book called The Dark Alliance by Gary Webb, and he's talking about how these, they were mostly Nicaraguans who were supporting the Contras in the 80s, which was the CIA's army in Central America. And they were supporting them by selling drugs and giving some of their drug profits to the Contras. And no one ever arrested. Everyone knew about these people. The government knew about them. They had a long list on it, but they never arrested them. But they also were bringing in guns. And they were bringing in quite sophisticated guns, you know, like Uzis, automatic weapons. Now, usually you'll find more sophisticated weaponry in black neighborhoods because of the drug traffic than you will in white middle-class neighborhoods. And Gary Webb really documented that a lot of these guns were coming from a guy who had some weird connection with the government that no one could ever quite figure out. The CIA said he's not our guy, but he definitely had a government connection, and that's how he was able to get these guns. And they went right into the black neighborhood, like you said, yes. And they went, that went with the drugs, you know. And that also, by the way, what really split up the black neighborhoods in L.A. was the gang warfare, the Crips and the Bloods.
Yes.
But that was all done through drugs and through guns. And the
and the E X C
Excuse.
To L O lock the B blacks
up. Yeah. And keep the police in the streets, right? Patrol the neighborhoods. I don't know. It sounds pretty intentional when we put it that way. I think some of it is that this crazy man, Bennett, who was the drug czar under Reagan, he had one priority, which was to get the dealing out of white neighborhoods. So where did it end up? It ended up in the black neighborhoods. And so whites started going to black neighborhoods to buy their drugs. And so the police arrest the blacks in the black neighborhoods and don't arrest the whites. I don't think it was 100% intentional, but it certainly was racist. Mm. It was racist, and that is the situation we still have and will have till we stop this war on drugs.
Where did it start?
I know it starts before World War II. I think one big thing was that America decided to back China. Chiang Kai-shek's KMT China, the Kuomintang China, against the Japanese. And the China was in a terrible mess. It was awash with opium. And Chiang Kai-shek was getting half his income from opium. Not because he really wanted to, but that was just the facts of life in China. And a fair amount of that, of his dollar earnings were from opium coming to the United States and distributed by the Chinese triads, the Tongs in the Chinatowns, Hipsings particularly, and by the Italian mafia. They were working together then. And if the American government was going to work with the Chinese government, this they inherited. And then, of course, a story that's told more often was during the war, we wanted to go into Sicily, and we enlisted the aid of the Sicilian mafia, who were very anti-Mussolini, because Mussolini had almost stamped out the mafia. So we allied ourselves with the mafia to get into Sicily during the war. And more importantly, after the war, we actually took a lot of American mafiosi out of jail, put them on army ships and planes, flew them, shipped them to Italy, and they became a kind of cadre of killers to fight the Communist Party. And they've become very, very big. I mean, Mussolini had the mafia almost stamped out. But with this alliance, this backing of the U.S. government, Vito Genovese was working out of the Allied military government. He was, if anyone knows the plot of Catch-22, that was really happening. And it involved American military government and American mafia. The problem is still there. And I don't think they intended it to blow back into the United States to the extent that it did. But the main source of heroin right after World War II was, number one, Italy, and then the Corsicans, because we allied ourselves with them, too, against the French communists, and then eventually from Taiwan, Thailand. Everywhere the CIA built up alliances, it was with people who were making their money from drugs. And the money was coming, ultimately, from the market in this country.
Why? Why?
Why? Well, the official reason was to stop communism. There are actually documents we have now from around 1949 authorizing unusual steps in Asia to ensure that the rest of Asia doesn't go communist. This is after China is now a communist China. But, of course, there were millions of Chinese in the rest of Asia. And they wanted desperately to prevent the Chinese in Thailand and in Vietnam and in Indonesia from switching their allegiance to the new government. And their main ally in doing this were these secret societies whose force with these overseas Chinese was by selling drugs. Paid for their armies, paid for their organization. We actually helped them grow more opium in Burma. Burma grew 40 tons of opium a year before World War II, and with CIA planes flying in and out, in 10 years it was up to 400 tons. Now it's more like 1,300 tons. It's a legacy of CIA activity in Asia, and a lot of those drugs came here.
Why? Do we always support the BRI? The bad guys.
Right. It's depressing. I thought maybe, you know, after the fall of the Soviet, up to before it was the Soviet threat, the Chinese threat. But there is no Soviet threat anymore, and China is not a threat. We want to trade with them, so I thought maybe it would stop. But this whole business in Kosovo, the Kosovo Liberation Army was branded in 1997, just 4 years ago, by the DEA as a terrorist organization being funded by drugs. And in 1998, they became our allies. So it's still happening. And there are a lot of people in the government who don't like this, I know. But when it comes to really dirty tricks, that's, you know, CIA business, and it's even one special part of CIA. And they, you know, they have certain procedures. They know certain kinds of people. The drug connections are global now. You know, the Colombians and the Russians are working together, and the Chinese are also working with the Mexicans. And the CIA is clued in with those people, and it looks like they're still going to be going with those people. Right, certainly into the 1990s, that was true.
We just, what we just read? Yeah, I have it here. We were reading a chapter from Howard Zinn's A People's History of the U.S.
Yeah.
And Frank wanted me to mark this paragraph.
Do you want me to read it, or you'll read it out loud?
Yeah, it was an old lesson learned by governments that war solves problems of control. Charles E. Wilson, the president of General Electric Corporation, was so happy about the wartime situation that he suggested a continuing alliance between business and the military for, quote, a permanent war economy.
Wow. Well, it's true that before World War II, the American economy was in a real mess.
Yes.
And, you know, people talked a lot about the New Deal and so on, but what really saved the American economy and the German economy and the Italian economy and the French and the British was preparing for war. It was what got the economy going again. Now, I think that, you know, cynics saw that in the late 50s there was a recession. And then Kennedy came in and said, we have to mobilize to fight new kinds of wars. And he had a huge defense budget, which certainly took care of that recession. But I don't think that Kennedy intended us to get into the kind of war that we did get into in the 60s. Some people disagree, but I've studied this quite closely. I think he wanted to build up the American defense establishment in a way which would keep the economy running. And before he was killed, I think he was already worried about the flow of gold out of the United States, and he had an operation to cut back on U.S. troops overseas in order to save the dollar, which was, you know, threatened by this flow of gold out of the country. The dollar in those days was still backed by gold. And that all changed when he was killed. And Johnson tried to have full employment and a war at the same time, and we got terrible inflation, and we did have to, you know, gold went from $35 an ounce to wherever it is now, between $300 and $400. It was such a mess that I don't think anyone brilliantly planned that thing. I think it was, this is where we come to deep politics again. There were things going on that were, the Charlie Wilson quote is a good quote, but that's from the 50s and from the Eisenhower period. And I think we really have evolved beyond that. And I will say, as somebody who has been predicting doom for capitalism for 40 years, I have to say, I think that capitalism is more sophisticated than it was in the 30s when only a war could get it out of a depression. And I think that they, you know, we're facing a recession right now. I don't think it'll be as acute as what happened in the 30s. I could be wrong.
It S E
seems
like it seems like the B A
bad guys.
S
no bastards.
I the basic R O O the basic routine of deep politics, the basic root of deep politics is O U
out of control.
Our E X no E C economy is B A based on the M I military.
Uh-huh. Well, it was. I sometimes think about deep economics as well as deep politics, because we come back to the drug trade. It's based, our prosperity unquestionably is based to some extent on the drug traffic, because the drug traffic taxes Americans, particularly the poor, in a way which enables third world countries like Colombia to pay off their debts to the U.S. banks who have made loans to them. This is also a factor in our economy. And we saw that. I actually talk about this in my poem, Minding the Darkness. It's so important. I have both a prose and a poetry version of this. Twice in the last 20 years, Mexico almost defaulted on its debt payments. And the first time in the 1980s, if this had happened, Bank of America and above all Citibank, the largest bank, two of the largest banks in America, had loaned so much money to Mexico that if Mexico had not made its debt not continued those debt payments, these two biggest banks would have been technically in bankrupt. They wouldn't have had enough assets for their loans. So the government felt forced to come in and loan money to Mexico to continue paying the banks as a way of forestalling bank failure. Well, how was Mexico going to earn that money? They were just about to go bankrupt. Before they lent the money in the 1980s, they commissioned a study from the CIA. How much of Mexico's foreign exchange earnings comes from drugs? And the answer was something like 75%, more than oil, more than... certainly more than straw hats and tourism and that sort of stuff. And it happened all over again in the 90s, right after Clinton became president. Clinton, overnight, he loaned more than $40 billion to Mexico to prevent the same thing from happening a second time. And this time we had, the estimate was from the Mexican Attorney General, saying that... more than 50% of Mexico's foreign exchange earnings, that's what pays back loans, more than 50% of it comes from drugs. So we are living on top of a drug economy that is helping to sustain what you might call the official economy. And I did a lot of research for the year 1981, which was, I wanted to put this in our book, Cocaine Politics. In world trade in 1981, the kind that they record officially, legitimate trade, was about $1 trillion a year. The CIA estimated that the global drug trade that year was half a trillion, $500 billion. So even if the figures are not exact, these are guesses, it's a big factor in how the world economy works. And because the United States is so well positioned with the major traffickers, I think that the money flows in the drug trade work to our advantage. Now, this is not the only thing. There's oil. Every country in the world pays for their oil in dollars. That's good for us because it means we can print little green pieces of paper off our printing presses, and they go all over the world to some very poor countries, have to buy them in order to pay for their oil. So there are a lot of weird things that are supporting our economy, but it isn't just because we're good at computers and that makes us so rich. There's a lot of these underhanded things that are helping to support the economy.
S. So, we don't want to stop. S. S-O. L. Solve the. S. O. So called drug problem.
Right. I think that right now, and again, I don't know how conscious this is. A lot of people are just doing their thing. You know, we've built a lot of prisons in California. We have a prison industry now. You have people in the one of the biggest lobbies in Sacramento now are the wardens of the prisons, and they like prisons. You know, I mean, it's an industry, and in some states they're actually hiring them out to private companies to build and run the prisons. Now, is this a cynical plan to put a lot of blacks away in jail? I think it's just the easiest route to a very bad solution. But I sort of agree with your question that right now nobody wants to go to, say, the Netherlands solution, which is drugs on demand to addicts, but they have to get them from the state, because very cheap drugs would destroy a whole economy, a whole industry, numbers of industries. We've become very adjusted to this.
And the A R M, the Army? No, the R A R M
the armies.
S
Armed Forces.
Arms T
Traffic.
Traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's tied in. In many ways. Of course, another big source of earnings for this country is selling arms all over the world. So, you know, when the newspapers talk about what's going on, say, in Congo or Burundi or Rwanda, they make it sound as if these terrible Africans are always killing each other. But who sold them all those arms? All the major powers did, the Americans and the French and the Belgians and the English, all selling arms all over the place. And in many parts of the Third World, the chief people buying the arms are the people who are running the drug traffic. That was the case in Thailand in the 50s, and that was the case in Burma and Afghanistan for a long time. You know, when the CIA went into Afghanistan, once again, the bad guys made an alliance with the drug traffickers, shipped not just guns to these people, but bazookas and missiles they could shoot up at airplanes. And these people are ruthless, and they have their own agendas. And those stingers, sidewinders, these are very dangerous weapons that can bring down civilian airliners. And these drug traffickers, I mean, they're businessmen. They started selling these things to Muslim terrorists all over the world. But they were our stingers. This is the sort of thing we call blowback. You start a policy for one intention, but it gets out of hand all over the place. And, yeah, there are a lot of arms out there that originally came from us, that it would be very much in U.S. interest to get them back if we could, but no, they're gone. They're out there.
How? G. U. Dumb. Or. S. Or smart. Are they?
Well, this is difficult for me. I think there are some people who in the government who are smart, but I think that when they decide to have to get into dirty tricks, covert operations, it gets assigned to people who are not overseen very closely by the rest of government. And they hire off the street. They hire a lot of people who are, first of all, ethically they're nothing. You know, they're ruthless, and those people are not very smart. I wouldn't say this about the whole of the CIA. You see, my experience is I was in the Canadian government, in the Foreign Service, and I met some Americans I really didn't like in the government and the CIA, but I also met CIA. Most of the analysts, the best analysts, are intelligence analysts in the CIA. And when I was in Poland with the Canadian Foreign Service, I'd been at the UN first, and I was so sick of having my arm twisted by American diplomats, I was becoming quite anti-American. I went to Poland. I liked most of the diplomats there, and I made four or five very good friends. And I was so naive, it was only about 5 or 6 years after I got back to this country that I realized these had been CIA people. They were very smart, but I don't think they were the kind of people who were working with drug traffickers. And I have, actually, I've met some drug traffickers, not a lot, but three or four big ones. They were smart.
What? A, I, A, like, oh, like my father. My father was a drug trafficker.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he spent some time in jail
I
for
see.
It.
Are we talking about big time or small time?
I think he was small time, don't you? I have no idea. M, I, middle. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the 60s, when there was a lot of tolerance for the drug trade, a lot of people, particularly musicians, instead of just buying it all the time, it was cheaper for them to, you know, trade it a bit. But I'm talking about big, I've met some world-class, big-time drug traffickers. One was French, one was American. Well, no, one was half Latino, half American. Both are quite famous. And both are very smart people. And in both cases, they were responsible for quite a few people getting killed, not just killed by cocaine, but killed in, shooting wars. But I can't blame it on these people being dumb. And they didn't, you know, they may have been bad, but they didn't come across as bad. They came across as businessmen. It's just like, you know, if you were to meet people in, say, Chevron, they would probably seem very civilized, decent people. But Chevron is doing terrible things to tribes in Nigeria. And
N-A, Nazis. Were N nice people,
yes.
Too.
Right, exactly. Yes, even the people at Auschwitz. When I was in Poland, I went to Auschwitz, and one of the letters there was an SS captain at Auschwitz. Now, he received a letter from somebody else in the SS saying, you know, we have two sweet little children, and we understand that in your line of business at Auschwitz, you have a surplus of baby carriages. So could you send us a baby carriage? So here's a loving father who's getting a free baby carriage from the Holocaust. I think that there's more of that in our own culture than we would like to face. I mean, we don't have an official Holocaust going on in the territory under our control, but we have been responsible for so many millions of people dying and so many millions of people working in really almost slave labor conditions that it's the indifference of this country so busy being nice to their kids that allows these things to happen.
F-R-O from the S-T-A-R from the start of O-U our H history.
Yes. You mean you're talking about the Indians? Yes.
Yes.
I write about that in my poem. And the it's such an irony that people who left England because they wanted to create a better society, when they ran up against the Indians, just the these things. Howard Zinn is very good on this, by the way. He's the whole, and that continued from the practices that were evolved in exterminating Indians on the Western frontier, went straight over to the Philippines at the 100 years ago, because the troops, the armies that went to the Philippines were commanded by people who had been involved in suppressing the Indians, and they used the same tactics. I've written about this both in prose and in poetry.
The G E T G E R German S T I S T U
studied.
Study?
How we did things. This is true.
Right.
Yes, they did. They did. And again, you know, it was the similarity really is, I think, that America always believed they had a wonderful civilization and it would be the best thing for the world if they just spread it around. Germans believed the same thing.
It is O U our are right to S P spread it to spread it all
yes,
over.
Yeah. Of course, this is where I am slightly different from, say, Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky. I believe that there are, in a sense, two Americas. And that there are people who have spread all the things that they have spread that we've been talking about, but also that Americans have been in the forefront in doing things for health. I mean, there are a lot of good things that America has done, too, and it's almost like there's something we never got straightened out inside this country. I mean, when all the time that... By the time all the Indians in the north had been killed and they were getting the big slaughters of Cherokees and people in the Choctaws in the south, you got, for the first time in history practically, a mobilized peace movement that was trying to stop that. And I feel that those of us who are in the anti-war movement, we represent a second American tradition that also goes back to the
yes.
Indian Wars.
Yes.
You agree with that?
Yes. Yeah.
And the trouble is, the other side has lots of money, and we don't. So we don't prevail,
and,
but we're growing.
And I, and they, W, R, I, write the history books.
No, both sides write their history books. And in the long run, I think the good guys' history books are going to prevail over the bad guys' history books.
That's great.
But military historians are amazing. You know, some people may have heard of the Sand Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado. This was a case where a tribe of Indians were told they could camp, and some other, by an army officer, and a National Guard officer called Chivington came riding in. He found all these Indians. He proceeded to slaughter them. They were doing nothing. And a lot of them were clubbed to death, and, I mean, it got into all kinds of sexual excess. I mean, it was horrible. And it's, America can't decide whether this was good or bad. Until recently, there were streets named after Chivington in Denver and in Boulder, Colorado, where there's been a protest and they've been removed. I really want to go on about this. The monument at the place where it happened says the Sand Creek Battle or Massacre. There's no agreement. And there was a military historian just about 16 years ago who wrote a book to say that Captain Chivington was perfectly right to do what he did, even though Congress called him a war criminal more than 100 years ago. So we are a very divided nation.
Why?
Why are we? Well, such different kinds of people came here. I think that, you know, the people came to New England to start a new society, and people came to Jamaica, to Virginia, to build plantations with slaves.
But is C A N is Canada?
Well, we have our own horrors, too. I mean, in fact, right now, Canada, like Australia, went through a period where they set up these schools and put all the Indians in the schools, and the idea was so they wouldn't be Indians anymore. They would be whites like everyone else. And it wasn't just that this was a kind of cultural genocide to begin with, but, you know, bad ideas usually produce very bad results, and you got a lot of sexual exploitation in these schools. So Canada, we have our problems too, and you have a very strong movement in Canada to make amends, and we've actually given a kind of autonomy to the Inuit Eskimos. But there are a lot of Canadians who really resent this. And right now, the right wing in Canada is becoming more popular, just won an election in British Columbia, because they resent all the things that have been done on behalf of the Indians. So we're having the same struggle in Canada. They're having the same struggle in Australia.
Is it you out our E I E U
Europe
European G genes? Is it our European genes?
Well, that you could talk about that. I've got Viking blood in me, and the Vikings certainly used to like to come in the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries. They would come in their ships, and they'd see a village, and they'd burn it, and they would settle. Well, the English were doing the same thing in Africa in the 1500s and 1600s and 1700s. But you know what? I don't think we should get too focused on just one. First of all, I don't believe in that races are all that different, and I don't think that cultures are all that different. And if we study what the Mongols did in Asia, it's very similar.
Yes.
So I don't think we should just get into a lot of guilt saying that we Europeans did it and nobody else did. No, I think there's a lot of good and bad mixed up in human nature everywhere since the beginning of recorded history. Do you agree?
Yes.
But it is true that in the 19th century, the big empires were all of them European. And in my research, I don't think there's a single empire that established itself without resorting to atrocities as a way of controlling native populations.
Why do people build empires?
Money. It was very, look how rich it made the English for a while. But, you know, very good studies have been done were done at the time to show that the kind of wealth that you acquire by empire isn't good for your home economy. It's bad for it. You take the example of Spain. Spain was the first empire. All that gold, silver they looted from Mexico and Peru, it wrecked the Spanish economy. And the Spanish economy went from being the most progressive in Europe to being the most backward. And what happened to England is quite similar, I think, that England was so fattened on the proceeds from the East India Company and the West India Company and for a while the slave trade that it created industries that were related to that kind of exploitation. And when the exploitation ended, English prosperity took a dive. And we want to be very sure. This could happen to America. And I think we don't know what will happen, but it could happen to America.
In reality, SLA, slave, E, slavery, was like that. In a way, slavery was like that.
Yes. Well, certainly it was. Again, there's been slavery all around the world, but no one carried it to the same extent, developed it to the extent that was done in England in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. And Marx made a very good point about England. Marx wasn't always wrong by any means. And he said that, you know, the English idea of aristocracy was such that somebody could be made a baronet from becoming wealthy through the slave trade. And there actually was a baronet who had a slave in chains in his coat of arms. But they never felt the same way about people who were merely productive, you know, creating shoes or clothes or something like that. That was middle class because that was mere trade and the other thing. But the other thing was this, you know, spreading the empire. So there were some very skewed ideas in England that tolerated slavery far too long, but there were two Englands. The heart of the anti-slavery movement came first in England, and it did come in America also. It's very inspiring to read the life of Garrison. A lot of people thought Garrison was crazy because they said, you can't do anything about slavery, but you could. And there are other things we could stop too. Other forms of exploitation that we can work on now.
P.E. People think we can not do anything about things.
Yes, especially right now. They've forgotten that you know, we helped stop a war, not all by ourselves, but we were the anti-war movement helped stop the Vietnam War, kept the casualties from getting even greater, prevented the use of nuclear weapons, which many people in Washington wanted to do.
And S H O R shortened the G U L Gulf War.
Gulf War. Yes, I think so. And certainly helped set limits to what Bush felt he could do in the Gulf War. we haven't been very good about ending the blockade, but it looks like it is going to end now, the blockade. Not because of what Americans did, though. Yes, if you take all the histories of anti-war movements, they're pathetically weak to begin with. Even in World War I, pathetically weak. People who refused to be conscripted, they were thrown in jail, even if they were famous like Bertrand Russell. And take the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement was something that the military planners had to take very seriously, and we want that growth to continue. That's why this Colombia business is so important now. I mean, here's a chance to have an anti-war movement in position before the war really gets going. And I hope to see that.
And the G L O globalization?
Oh, yes. Right. That's a very tough one. Very complicated, I think. Because in a way, I want the world to be more global. But I just don't want it to be the FTAA way or the WTO way.
Who?
There has to be a better way.
What they call globalization is really I am imperialism.
Imperialism. Well, what's happening? See, of course, what's happening now isn't even globalization. The FTAA in particular is a way of hemispherizing the American economy and weakening rather than strengthening our links to the rest of the globe and particularly to Europe. And I think that I think that we may see some terrible trade wars coming in the next decade if Bush doesn't start building bridges to Europe again. What's worth protesting here, and I think is the main thing that has brought so many people out in the streets, are these agreements that essentially give all the power to the corporations, and it's the end of democracy. People can pass laws in a country.
Yes.
You know, in Canada, we didn't want to have a certain additive in our gasoline because it was proven to be carcinogenic. And because of NAFTA, Canada was fined for having done this. It didn't matter that they'd passed a law. No, this was now we had something higher, which was the needs of the American corporations. And so now Canadian corporations are doing the same thing to California, but also about additives. And this is terrible. I hate to build up a campaign against the word globalization because we have to be less nationalistic in the future,
a,
no question.
The E, the E-R, no, the R, E, A, the real G, globalization, would be A, what would be when, where people could move around freely,
move around
from
right.
country to country.
I think my formula would be that good globalization would be anything that spreads empowerment, that empowers people. And bad globalization, which is what we're seeing in FTAA, is the exact opposite. It takes away from people the powers they already have. It's really retrogressive that, you know, two centuries of progress in social legislation and control is going down the tubes. And the result's going to be that our economies are going to work much worse, not better. And you can see it coming. I mean, just this deregulation and what is done to power in California is a kind of metaphor for what's going to happen to the world if we can't find a better way than what we've got right now.
A G L O Global M I N I U M
Minimum wage.
Minimum wage. Good.
Right. Right. You know, my wife, ex-wife, had a lovely bumper sticker. A global minimum wage and a global maximum wage.
Yes, right. Yes.
Now we're talking.
Frank has been talking about a maximum wage for years.
Yes. And you know what? I know a retired vice president from the Bank of America. And once upon a time, when I met him, I would have thought I was meeting Satan. He agrees. He says nobody, no CEO should make more than 30 times what the minimum wage is in his face. So if people at the top can think that, how are we going to make that happen? I'd like to tax extreme wealth in a way that makes it look almost like a crime to be a multi-billionaire, you know?
M-O-N, money, M A makes C R A C crack C crack C cocaine look.
Oh, I see. Yes. Right. People get addicted to money. They do. They do.
Uh-huh.
Right. And you know, and again, you know, if you got to know, I've never known these crazy billionaires, like the guy who bought Pacific Lumber, and started clear cutting. You know, he took a very progressive company, said, I can make more money out of it by clear cutting instead of rational cutting. I would love to know those people and to find what sickness it is in them. I think it's less the money than the competition, you know, that they want to be bigger than the next person. I feel like in the days when I taught grade school and you had to take the kids in the corner and pull them apart. And
they B R E break B R E A breathe.
Yes.
The same air as we do.
Yes.
But they don't see connect that they don't connect that. They don't think of other people. No,
I think he means that they breathe the same air that we do, but they don't see that they have to take steps to protect the air and keep it clean.
Oh.
Yeah,
wow.
Right. No, I think that a lot of, you know, I think the sort of Chomsky model for America is that there's the people at the top know exactly what they're doing, and they know how to maximize their power. And my feeling is that there's something profoundly wrong about this society that has allowed people to rise to the very top who have only the dimmest idea what they're doing and who think they do a lot of things which they think will make themselves happy, and they don't. And actually, every culture that I know, from Chinese, Indian, European, the wise men in that culture, including Jesus Christ, talk about how greed destroys society. And this is such an old-fashioned truth. We hardly listen to it. But I think that's the bottom line of what's wrong here, is that we have taken greed and we sort of worship it now. And, you know, we actually had a man come to the business school at Berkeley, and he said, these are his words, greed is good. This was a year before he went to jail. But greed is not good. But there's very little in our culture that tells us that. Am I being too old-fashioned when I say this?
No.
Okay,
no.
Thank you.
No.
That's my poem. That's why I write poetry. I want in poetry to bring people back to the truths that have been said so often that it's hard to hear them. But if you can say them again in a slightly different way, maybe people will listen. The founding fathers of this country were very worried about greed, and they were very worried about banks, and
yes,
they were very worried about big corporations.
Yes.
I want to remind people today that that's the spirit in which this republic was created.
Would you read some of your poems?
I'll read just on that one particular point. Yes, I will. Thank you. That's my new book, just out, Minding the Darkness, available in bookstores and on Amazon and other places. And I'll read one section which I think pulls together quite a few of the things we've been talking about. One of the lines of poetry is taken off the back of a dollar bill. And probably people can't see it on the television, but if you get a dollar bill out of your wallet and you see the pyramid and the eye and these mysterious phrases, annuit coeptis and novus ordo seclorum, which come from Virgil, the second one, this picture is a line in my poem. And I think I'll stop and explain things as I go along. Virgil wrote an eclogue in which he had a vision of a new golden age that would be better than the original golden age, in which everything would be perfectly organized and people would be happy. And he said that a child will bring this in. Well, of course, when the Christians came along very shortly afterwards, they said Virgil must have been thinking of Christianity. I don't think he was, but by that fluke, it became a very famous poem, his fourth eclogue. And my first, I'm quoting at times from that eclogue, because the eclogue is quoted on a dollar bill. Novus Ordo Seclorum means a new order of ages, in the plural, by the way. It doesn't mean new world order. It means a new order of ages, that there can be progress into a new future, which Virgil was saying, and which the founding fathers, obviously a belief they shared, because somebody put it into the dollar bill. It's actually in the great seal of the nation, which is on the dollar bill. And now for something a bit more serious. That's actually a line from Virgil. A poem that looks at the eye in the triangle above the blunted pyramid. In other words, a poem that looks at money. If we really want poetry to change the world, it better look at money, because right now money is changing the world. And then I reproduce part of the bill, and then I say, it is not just blasphemous, but illegal to reproduce too much of this icon, because if I reproduced the whole bill, I'd be in jail for counterfeiting. It would weaken our current faith, which is to say our credit, and its temple, the Federal Reserve. I'm going to skip a bit. A temple, the Federal Reserve is responsible for our money policies right now, and that's why Greenspan is so important. A temple so inscrutable, Howard Zinn, barely mentions it among the progressive reforms aimed at quieting the popular risings. He saw it as a reform. I don't see it as a reform at all. I see it as a kind of, I see the Federal Reserve and the CIA as being two institutions above our democracy that get to draft the clauses in NAFTA and FTAA and the rest of it. Though we continue to prate about the open society, and now here's a quote from the Federal Reserve, 54% of the total net financial assets are held by the 2%. That's the kind of financial concentration we have in this country. More than half of it is in the hands of just a handful of people. And that's what's fundamentally wrong with everything. It's why our politics don't work, our party system doesn't work, our elections don't work, our economy doesn't really work, because too much money is just going up to the top and disappearing. Okay, the 2%, whose two top institutions, the Fed and the CIA, the most powerful and unpopular, lie beyond the reach and even the comprehension, not just of the people, but Congress, the legal system, and the press. And then I come to what I said about the Mexican bank failure. Here it is in poetry. In the crisis of 1982, when Mexico almost defaulted on its $80 billion debt, the largest banks would have been, and this is a quote now from an economist, swamped in the resulting panic had they not been saved by actions taken in secret between the Fed and the Treasury. An unprecedented bailout was arranged, $3.5 billion in new loans for Mexico. So why did the Intelligence Council, concerned about foreign exchange, produce a CIA evaluation, and this is a quote from the CIA, the profits of drug export revenues of Colombia and Mexico probably represent 75% of source country export earnings. And my answer to that question is that they wanted to be sure that Mexico could pay back the $3.5 billion. And the drugs ensured that they could, and without the drugs, there's no way they could. It's that simple. Then I talk about the head of the Mexican DFS, which is their CIA, and this man, Nazar Haro, was a CIA asset. Nazar Haro, the DFS chief, who sold protection to the drug traffickers and obstructed the investigation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, that was into the Kennedy assassination, was protected in turn by the CIA from an indictment in San Diego for his, and here's another quote, indispensability as a source of intelligence. The objecting U.S. attorney fired for revealing this. Here's a man who was a major smuggler, and this U.S. attorney was so furious that he leaked to the press. The result was that he lost his job. And why did the Treasury in 1984 introduce bearer bonds? Despite the expert advice, they would become instruments used by the traffickers for money laundering. The Fed and the CIA, both so powerful, we know almost nothing about them. Not to mention the IMF, whose draconian remedies for impoverished countries like Yugoslavia and Rwanda and perhaps now Indonesia, have been followed by massacres. Another quote from an economist. If the secrets were revealed, the money mystery would dissolve. People would have to look upon these things directly. Why put all this in a poem? There are times when the most novel act of creativity is to aim at the simplest truth. And here it is in a nutshell. The rich are getting richer, the poor poorer, and if not checked, this will destroy us. Why does this happen? Bassesse oblige, the opposite of noblesse oblige. If you're rich and corrupt, you've got to do it. There's no other reason. And the cure? We must live by what we have always known. No crime worse than avarice. That's a quote from the Tao Te Ching, 2,000 years old or more. Likewise, the political hegemony of money must end. That's what somebody who really looked into this thing said. One need not even abolish the Fed. only find the will to abandon money's value to save the real economy. The problem is not even capital. The new fluidity from America, which, as Marx observed, erased those feudal English preconceptions, and this is Marx now, when it was respectable to sell Negroes into slavery, but not to make sausages, boots, or bread. No, the problem is the abuse of capital power, always consolidating privilege by taxing the misery of the poor. When the president of the bank, and this is Bank America now, can reward himself after slashing 12,600 jobs with a one-year salary and bonus of $76 million, how shall we talk of America's doctrine of equality? We have not failed at production. We have failed at distribution. If we have learned anything in the 2,000 years since Virgil, it is to expect no moral progress from our political leaders or, and I like this quote, the banks, British merchants, and insurance companies feared by our founding fathers. And that's an actual quote from Madison, who was writing to Jefferson, what are we going to do about these big companies? And Adams and Jefferson felt the same way. And none either from that supreme abstraction, money, which empowers a worker to act as a free agent in the surface process of equality and freedom, beneath which in the depths entirely different processes go on. That's from Marx, and it shows that Marx in his own way also believed in deep politics and deep economics. So I wanted to get that quote in. Money as an abstraction, unifying our world, at the same time making obsolete the first meaning of commonwealth. The first meaning of commonwealth was the common good, or the common welfare. Who thinks about that now? We're being told to forget about it. Thus, in the last 50 years, here's a quote from Shelley now, for want of correspondence with the imagination, the CIA has helped install the thugs of drug cartels in Thailand, Bolivia, Afghanistan, Haiti, and Peru, accelerating the flow of profits from the poorest nations to the richest. Why houses cost so much? In 1984 alone, the Commerce Department calculated a net influx of foreign capital into the U.S. at about $100 billion. That's why, like, ordinary folks like us can't buy homes. They're being bought by rich people from Hong Kong and Colombia and other places. While with draconian drug laws in the name of order, we had 1 million people in prisons by the year 1994 and 1.8 million just 4.5 years later. It's now doubled in less than a decade. And should my poem take refuge in rich, sensuous detail, or shall I say more clearly what we removed from our prose book? That when Clinton and the Fed lent Mexico $40 billion, it should have been clear even then how this debt would be repaid. Here's a quote from a major Latin American journal. Mexico's Attorney General's office states that drug traffickers earned $28 billion in 1992 and 1993, amounts similar to all of the country's legal exports combined. So once again, it's the drugs that's going to pay back the loans that keep the American system working. For the benefit of this corrupt ordo seclorum, order of ages, all of us, without thinking, carry round in our billfolds. End of one section. Now, the poem talks about many other things, but I really go after money in that particular section because I think that poetry should try to understand the world we live in, and you cannot understand the world we live in if you don't look at money. That's just the way it is.
B I B U S business S C H school teaches.
Yes.
That you're going to make all of your money from 80% of the people are not going to be the source of your success, of your money. It's only going to be 20%.
Mm-hmm. I don't like what they teach in the business schools, I must say.
That
I'd rather have them come and read a little ethics and a little poetry.
R.E. reveals a lot in terms of how the experience of dealing with businesses and how you're often treated when you're doing business with somebody,
uh-huh.
that they're kind of not, they're disregarding that 80%.
Well, I just know that, you know, the students I teach, a lot of them go into business and then an awful lot of them come back out because they can't hack it because it's so inhumane. Just as myself, I went into government, and after 5 years, I couldn't hack it, because even Canada's not the worst of countries, but we had to do so much in cahoots with the Americans and with the whole world system.
Why did you go into business in the first place? No,
into government.
Into government
in the first place. I was very young. My father was a teacher, professor. I didn't want to do what my father did. I was in a revolt against my father. And so he was a professor. I would do something else. So, and I was getting married. I had to have an income. So I took the exams and I got in. And to be quite honest, I had a good time. I enjoyed my 4 years in government, but I would have been an alcoholic if I'd stayed in. There was no real nourishment there, you know. It was very theatrical. I got to go to very elaborate parties and drink expensive champagne and wine, but it was meaningless. So in the end, I had to do what my father did and taught. It was better than being a diplomat. And then eventually I became a writer, and that's the best of all for me.
How did you become a writer?
Well, I'd always done it. My father was a writer. This is ridiculous. My grandfather was a published poet. My father was a published poet. So they had me writing when I was about 4 years old or something. But I never really seriously said, I wrote poetry, I published poetry, I wasn't a writer. And then I got hepatitis when I was 48, and it was very severe. It was in England, and I spent 3 weeks in total isolation in a ward, thinking I might die. I mean, it was the sickest I'd ever been. And I decided that life was so precious that I'd better only do what was most important. So I decided then to be a poet. And only 2 years later, I started this very long poem. It's in 3 volumes, which I've just read from the 3rd volume. And that's, you know, I do a lot of other things too, but I have to do something important or my life is not worth it, you know. And for me, everybody, people do different things. My sons are musicians. My daughter has a wonderful project with an urban garden in one of the poorest neighborhoods around Richmond. But she has something that makes life worthwhile, and for me, that's poetry.
Yes. It is U N U unusual.
Unusual.
M no. Your C O M combination.
Oh, yes. You mean that I've... Well, what's very common is for poets to be in anti-war movements. But what's less common is for former diplomats. But there are some. There are quite a few. My best friend and my best man in my wedding, Daniel Ellsberg, he was in the government. He saw it was terrible. We often ask ourselves, and we knew some more people like ourselves, and we actually at one point had a group of them. And first of all, we wanted to know what it was that made us all, you know, in a sense, see what was wrong about what we were doing. But then the other question, which we could never answer, is why were there so few of us? And there are not many Daniel Ellsbergs. Although there are more, I think, more and more. No.
It is G-R-A-V, gravity.
Yes. Is that the end of it, or is gravity...
I think that's the end of the sentence. It is gravity.
You mean that this is the natural way we're going to evolve?
See? The M, A, S, the mass, is A, G, A, against. Us, the mass is against us.
Well, you know, what Chomsky believes, which I partly believe, is all you have to do is tell the masses what's happening, and then they'll be on our side.
Not the masses, but the mass.
Well, this is...
What do you mean by the mass when you say the mass is against us? The
mass in a physical sense? Or
the mass in a physical sense, yes.
Well, we're getting to a sort of almost religious level here. I do believe that there is, you know, it's clear, whatever you believe, the universe is evolving. It's not what it was a few billion years back. And it's possible it's evolving randomly, and it's possible that there is some kind of relationship between what the universe is doing and what we should do. And I believe the latter, because I believe the only way you can understand the miracle of intelligence is, what is intelligence? It is some kind of special relationship to the physical universe that we are in. And we can, to a limited extent, we can understand it on a physical level. And I believe if we had a whole generation of everyone who was educated to understand the physical universe, we wouldn't have the kind of moral wretches and thieves and exploiters that we have. That's not compatible with the use of intelligence. And I believe that the evolution of our own world history is favorable to the evolution of intelligence. And that's, again, I have quite a lot about this in my poem that goes beyond money.
It is A.M. amazing. M.O. S, most, P,
people, want,
who,
oh, who,
I, interview, R, H, O, hopeful.
Yes. I don't know why, but I am. I am hopeful. And I think, again, you know, there's the intelligence up here, and there's the emotional intelligence. up here has no reasons to be hopeful, but I am hopeful, and it's from something down here. I've been lucky enough to be in love. I'm very happily in love right now.
We. V. I. D. Videoed the prisoners' conference. There was a prisoners' conference recently in Oakland, like a week-long thing.
Political prisoners'
conference, and we covered it, and we have it archived on our site. But one of the things Gerald Sanders had asked if Frank would
my
come
student,
up.
My student, Jerry Sanders.
Oh, wow. he's got a show, a couple shows here on Lover.
Really?
Yes.
You mean Jerry Sanders, who runs peace studies at the university? Or
Gerald Sanders. He's also known as Gerald Smith. He's a political activist.
It's someone else.
Yes.
There's a Jerry Sanders who helped start a peace studies program on the campus, and a Jerry Sanders runs that.
Different. But he had asked for a series of questions to ask these political prisoners, and he went around during the concert and we interviewed them. And one of the questions was, are you bitter? Was that the question?
Oh, yeah.
Nobody said yes.
These guys are in jail.
These are people that have been in prison, some of them, most of their adult life and for not doing anything.
Right.
And nobody was bitter. And they were so hopeful.
Well, that's
and they
the key
were so
to surviving,
loving.
Of course.
Yes.
It's like in the at Auschwitz. The people who survived were the people who didn't just get angry and bitter. If you've read Primo Levi, it's
she, it, L, O, loving, yes, a very loving group of people they were, yes.
You know, one of the beautiful things that is happening very much in the Bay Area, but all over America, is the communities going into the prisons and making contact with all the prisoners, not just the political prisoners.
Yes.
And helping to reach their humanity. Very important work. I'm a Buddhist, or at least I'm part of a Buddhist community, and they have a Buddhist project to go in, but all kinds of people are going, and some of the writers in the English department go in and teach creative writing to the prisoners, and there's amazing poetry being published from the prisons, not people who were in prison, but who are in prison.
Yes.
And managed to write poetry.
We get poems, some. Yes, we've published poems in our zine from prisoners, some of the most incredible poems.
Well, I had a poem in an issue of Witness, it's a journal. And most of the poems in the journal were by prisoners, and I really felt humbled to be. They were very, very good. In a sense, you know, you need to have had some kind of dislocating experience to write poetry. Well, prisoners have had that, so.
It's just about 10 o'clock. Yeah. So is that a wrap? H. E. Hey. Hey. If you are W. A. T. If you are watching on B. On BTV, if you're watching this on BTV, welcome. Welcome to what we're doing.
Well, I'm going to have to get to be more computer savvy before I can tune in. I don't know how to do it yet.
We're starting, Frank, we're starting a show on the Public Access Channel in Berkeley on Monday, tomorrow.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a 2.5-hour weekly program.
That's Channel 25?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes, it's called Frank Moore's Unlimited Possibilities. And
wow.
A lot of what we're doing is taking these Shaman's Den shows and putting them together, showing them in their entirety and adding footage if it's short, 2.5 hours. Because we realize there's so many incredible conversations we have, we wanted to get it out on TV, too.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
That's absolutely
It's 12:30.
Fantastic. 12:30?
12:30 a.m., Mondays.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to change my life in other ways.
It's also on at midnight on Thursdays. That's not much earlier. S-O. So, when they see this on BTV. Yes. They may, they will. W, they will have. S, seen. M, O, N, months of this program.
Great.
Yes, that's right.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. Starting Monday.
Tomorrow, yes.
Well.
Yes.
Now, do you have to go down there, or are they just taking your tapes?
We brought down 5 shows, and then we'll bring down 5 more shows. And
I see.
Yeah. And L.A. And it's going to be on Los Angeles Public Access TV, too. We have a sponsor down there.
See, this is what I also believe about technology, that a lot of things are developed, including the computer networks. It was all developed for the rulers, but we can use it too.
Yes, yes, yes. I always have used the technology to do this kind of thing. P. E. People gave. Well, Frank's been using a computer since the 70s, and a lot of our friends gave Frank a hard time and saying, you're supposed to be all about people, and why are you getting into this technology? And those same people now have email, And
right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I went around making converts myself, but I only started in the early 80s.
Yes.
Mm. Well, thank you very much. This was a great privilege.
Yes.
Well, so one way or another, I'll just have to stay up late, I guess.
Somebody said set your timer on your VCR.
I don't know how to do that either. So.
Yeah. Okay. We are archive. Yes, like this show will be archived on our website on the internet. So
right. Well, if you're ever going to put it on, let me know. And I had you up on my own website.
Yes.
And then I took it down, and then you said you were rerunning it, and I didn't have time to get it back up. But
yes.
Give me a bit of time, and I'll always put it up on my own website. Because I get, not a lot of people, but it's about 10 or 12 people a day come to my website.
When it is when it's archived, we'll send you that information for your website, because then people can watch it. I guess listen to it whenever they want to.
Thank you very, very much.
Yes. Okay, so coming up next is at 11 o'clock, Dr. Susie Block, followed by Playing with Passion. Yes, and next week, A.M. Amazing, D.A., an amazing dance, Playing with Passion, that we just videoed this past week with Jen. Mm. So that's at midnight. So stick around till midnight. And next week is Elliot Lessing, who's a video maker from San Francisco. Your player is... Oh, no, here comes burn first. And after burn, your player will stop and you have to hit play again. That's not what I came here for. I don't want to have pepper sprayed in my eyes. I don't want the candy surprise. So gather around and we'll sing a song. Make it very long. We'll call it Pop the Bomb. Gather around, we'll have a drink. 'Cause we're on the brink of war. War. Fuck the war. Fuck the bomb. Fuck those who ignore. The killing is wrong. It's wrong to kill. To maim. For oil. Game. I don't want to be in somebody else's fight. I don't want to be scared at night. I don't want to have to march for every single fucking right. But if I do, I will. Gather around and we'll sing a song. We'll make it very long. Call it Fuck the Bomb. Gather around and have a drink. 'Cause we're on the brink of war. War. Fuck the war. Fuck the bomb. Fuck the war. Hey. I don't want to be in the war, no, I don't want to be in the war. Fuck the war, fuck the bomb, fuck the death penalty, free mommy and food tomorrow. Fuck rape, fuck the gun, fuck the war, fuck the bomb, hey! I don't want to be in the war, no, I don't want to be in the war. Fuck the war. Fuck breast cancer and lung cancer, prostate cancer too. Fuck Nike ads and useless fads, the bullet and the brew. Though the brew is very tasty, fuck the way it makes us nasty. Fuck men who blacken women's eyes, domestic violence and all its lies, broken bones and children's cries. I don't want to be in the war, no, I don't want to be in the war. Fuck the war. Fuck those who try to stop the flow of ganja, who will lock us up for us. They're all misdemeanor, three strikes are out. And meaner streets, meaner wars, meaner bombs, meaner people. I don't want to be in the war, no, I don't want to be in the war. Fuck the war, fuck the war, fuck the war. Fuck the war. All right.
And that was Peter Dale Scott live on Frank Moore's Shaman's Den. back on May 20th of this year. And you heard Byrne there singing Fuck the War. And we're going to go to some music now. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Frank Moore Shaman's Den. This week there's no guest, but we are going to play one of the Frank Moore's Unlimited Possibilities cable TV shows this week featuring Thrush TV. So that will be coming up at 8 o'clock. All right, now your player's going to stop, and you got to hit play again.